Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Dr. Isabel Romanowski, a psychologist and executive coach turned management academic, who is nowadays recognized internationally as a leading authority on how people develop a sustainability mindset. So much so that she now leads the United Nations Working Group on Sustainability Mindset, otherwise known as LEAP. Argentinian by birth and now living in the States, I spoke to her online from her home in Florida. So Isabel, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you.
I've been so excited about talking to you for this interview, not least because the whole business of being a change agent has been your life's work in terms of studying what the nature and condition of it is for an individual to be a change agent. So I'm really keen to get into what you've learned from that and what guidance there might be from your research for anyone out there who's listening to this this podcast and wondering how they become more effective in what they're trying to achieve. So, but before we get into that, what I'd love to do is sort of wind the clock back in terms of what on earth got you into this in the first place.
I think the main turning point happened in about 2003. And I did a tech talk about that, but let me share it with you anyway. I was working as an executive coach, a team coach, and I liked my work. And one day we had a training session for coaches. And in the training session, the exercise was the Amazing Achievement Award, which is a type of a visioning exercise where you ask people to think 7 years into the future. And putting yourself 7 years in the future, you will be receiving an award for something amazing you did. So the exercise is about writing the speech, the acceptance speech for that award, and stating, okay, what is it that you did, and who helped you, what were some obstacles, and how you went over those obstacles, etc. So we had about half an hour to do that, and I was very excited because I like this type of exercise. But a few minutes into it, I started to think, so why would anyone give me an award? And I realized that although I was happy, I had a happy life, and things were going good, and I was working, I was getting paid for it, clients liked it, but really nothing that I was doing, I could project it into the future, not even the present, to receive an award because it was not an amazing achievement. It was just I was doing my work well. And that was, a turning point because it was like an existential crisis I had in that very short period. Suddenly, I had half an hour and to come up with the speech, but there was something before the speech that I was realizing that nothing in my life was deserving an award. And so I tried to do some self-coaching. I said, okay, take a deep breath. Time is clicking. And what will you do now? Well, see, what are the things that you're good at that maybe in a different context it could become something that deserves an award in the future? So I started to do a list of things that I like to do or I was good at. And I came up with this idea, okay, I will become a legacy coach. I will work with leaders who want to make a difference. And in some way, they don't know how to do it. So I will help them think it through how they can make a difference. And because of that coaching, they will be doing amazing things through their organizations. And that was the greater good, not my coaching, but I was would be sort of instrument. That was the best I could find in the time. And I felt very happy. And in a way, it gave me a new goal. But it was more than a goal. I think it opened myself to a different dimension of being, to a different review of what I was doing and why I was doing what I was doing. And connecting the work not only with my skills or something that I like to do, but what is the larger purpose? What is my contribution to the world with what I am doing? Which is a question that I hadn't asked myself before. After that, I said, well, let me plan backwards. If in 7 years this should happen, what do I need to do before that? What are the steps to get there? And that was a useful exercise. It happened all in half an hour. And so I started, why would these leaders pay attention to me? Oh, maybe I am teaching in a business school. And then they know me, or maybe I wrote a book. Oh, so I need to write a book. Oh, okay. And I hadn't written a book by that time. And then I said, well, they also know me because I'm teaching. But oh, to get to teach in an executive program or a master's level, I need to earn a doctorate. So I said, oh, I should sign up for a doctorate program. So I planned it sort of backwards. And after half an hour, I felt very happy because I felt that a new door had opened.
You created your own burning platform.
Yes.
It created enough urgency to say, I only have 7 years to get that done.
Yeah. I don't know that I took the 7 years so literally. It was, I didn't put timing. I knew that I had to do the steps before getting there, but I never said, well, it has to happen in 7 years. Interestingly, however, my unconscious was programmed through that without me knowing it. And that is what happens so much when we set intentions, you know, we program our unconscious. And so it was the year 2010 when I was walking the halls in my graduation ceremony to get my doctoral degree. But I really was not thinking, oh, I have to work towards 7 years. Suddenly I noticed, oh, it was 7 years ago. I had forgotten that, that timeline. But what opened up is that by once it was this personal process that where I said, what is the difference I want to make? And when you said, what did you learn? I wrote down that question. I think that it all started with myself. It didn't start with researching change makers. It started with being having moments of standing in front of the mirror and looking at myself, what I was doing and what my values were and how the values were consistent with who I wanted to be. That was the most important aspect, I think, that I learned. And then obviously, because I started my doctoral degree, I said, if I want to be an expert in legacy coaching, let me learn how people become interested in shaping the legacy while they are working, not when they retire, but while they are still doing things. And that became what I wanted to study. Why some leaders have that natural inclination to be champions of change towards a community good or environmental causes in their organization. Not philanthropy, but really changing the organization, which became the line that I researched things.
But I hadn't appreciated that the starting point for you was not so much a connection on sustainability. It was more about this interest around legacy mindset. And of course, I can see where the convergence is between the two. and it's become more apparent for more people. I mean, just anecdotally, my own observation would be that people acquire a legacy mindset as they go through their career. It's not something that you start out with at 18 or 20 when you just start, you know, at that point it's about first rung on the ladder and so on. But as you progress through your career, you start thinking about your own mortality, your own career coming towards an end at some point, and thinking about what your own contribution is going to be.
I think that the word legacy is suited for people that go through some kind of trauma that puts them face to mortality. But the motivation to make a difference not always is connected with the idea of mortality. And so in younger people, it is the cause that inspires them.
Right.
When they see that they can make a difference, and I think the young energy is about, oh, I want to change the world, I want to do something. It's not so much about, oh, I only have 70 years to live, because that feels like forever. You're young, you are immortal. But this desire, oh, actually, I can do something, or we can do something together with others, and this empowerment, I have found it in very young people. Mm-hmm. So the motivation may come from different experience, and that is, yes, where you say age and or experiences play a role, but not so much in the power of the motivation and where it can be channeled towards the same idea of making a difference or working for the greater good.
So in more recent years, you've then got into working on sustainability mindset. So where did the convergence come about between you?
Oh, it came very early. I was walking in an art gallery with a friend in Argentina. I was visiting Argentina. And in Buenos Aires, I met with a friend. And we decided to go and visit the art gallery. And while we were walking and talking, she said, I heard that you will enroll in a doctor's degree. Oh, well, that's good. And what will your topic of research be? I said, oh, I want to work, explore leaders leaving a legacy. And she said, what do you mean? Well, leaders that make a difference through their work and the community or the environment. She said, oh, CSR. And I said, what do you mean by CSR? She said, oh, that is called corporate social responsibility. I said, well, I never heard that word. And so she explained a little bit. And when I came back, she was just starting the design of a master's in sustainability in Argentina. And so she said, you know, I'm having problems finding literature. Would you mind doing a Google search and finding what are the books available on this topic that I could recommend to the students? Although they will be in English, but I can. So I said, oh, yes, I can do that. And when I started putting these words in the Google, I found, I don't know, at that time, 1,500 or 2,000 titles. That was 2003 or 2004. I said, what? What is that? And I bought 15 books that day. I never bought so many books in one sitting. But I just said, I need to learn about this. This is a new word. I didn't know. What is corporate responsibility, sustainability? What are they talking about? This was all new language for me. At the same time, I saw that it was connected with what I was thinking of. But it had a different language. So that was when I realized that it was connected, what I was calling people making a difference in the community through their work or the environment, had a different way to approach it, or has had some words and some thinking around it.
And it's
so it converged very early.
It's right. It's interesting too that, I mean, I guess from your professional background as a psychologist, your departure point on this is what goes on between our ears as an individual. Whereas for many people involved in the CSR, or if you wind the clock back further, you know, the kind of environmentalist movement, or for that matter, sort of social justice and so on, I'm thinking much more at a kind of epidemiological kind of scale, you know, it's population scale, about society. They're not thinking so much about the individual. So there's an interesting kind of convergence there too, around sort of how do you relate the individual perspective to the macro level.
Well, another component came that when I was looking for where to do my doctoral program, the place that I chose was Teachers College in Columbia University. Mm-hmm. And I chose that one because it had a very different approach. It was a cohort, and I didn't have to move to New York, but also the way they approached teaching was very much spoke to me. It was not a traditional doctoral program, but there were a lot of the pedagogy that was used was closer to what I felt comfortable. So it was more based on adult learning because it was a teacher's college. And when I had to phrase my doctoral focus, my advisor said, well, you're in teacher's college, so it has to have something related to learning. You cannot just say what are the motivations of individual, why they do it, because that would be in the school of psychology. But we are here, and so your questions have to connect with the learning process. And I said, well, that is good. So I said, how do people learn? What happens? What is the information they have? Are there aspects that can be replicated if we would like to develop a generation, intentionally develop a generation that is more open to this type of behaviors? So I was forced into the so what question, why am I doing this? And so I like the idea of finding sufficient elements, if there are any, so that we can become intentionally and do trainings or programs or workshops or find learning goals, learning outcomes that can lead people to become more sensitive to these topics. If there are any, I didn't know. I thought maybe they were all traumatic experiences and the person was a regular businessman until one day he had near-death experience, and that changed his mind or became religious or was religious. So there were things that I knew could not be replicated, but I wanted to know if there were any that could be replicated. So the learning and the behavior were sort of connected through that lens. And that is where I started to discover that in the journey of these people that I studied, there was one or several moments, turning points, where they confronted themselves very much like it had happened to me. But I didn't discover that in the moment. I was just studying them, and many years later, I said, oh, this similar process to what happened to me. I had this shock of looking in the mirror and saying, well, this is not the person I want to be. And so it happened to them too. And
were these moments of high consciousness for them, these turning points along the way? Are these things that have caused them, you know, a reason to pause and reflect and, you know, ask themselves serious questions?
Yes. It's like opening a can. Mm. I don't want to say worms, but it is opening a box. And once you open that, you cannot close it again. And I think you have seen it maybe in many people that talk about the spiritual awakeness, or they talk about enlarging your consciousness. There's something that once it opens, you cannot close it. And we can live in putting blindfolds or blinders on and not seeing to the right or to the left. But in the moment we take them off, we know what is there, and it's very difficult to take this off from our awareness. So the rest of our days are marked by these new understandings. And if the understandings relate to who I am, who I want to be, and there is a dissonance, a cognitive dissonance between what I think about myself and what I now realize I'm doing, that is a tension, that is very strong motivation. That is actually, I found, stronger motivation the knowing facts and saying, oh, that let me do it. This would be a good business case, or maybe we could earn some more credibility if we follow the green road. That doesn't have the same motivational power, the energy that comes from the personal transformation.
And do you find that, is that an entirely conscious thing for the individual, or are there formative experiences that have informed their outlook, but without them being particularly conscious about them?
Well, I found both. For example, some people could identify that in their upbringing there were some experience that prepared them. For example, some people were living more in nature or had more exposure to nature, and it was very normal for them. And then when they moved to more urban environments, they forgot. But at some point, they remembered and said, actually, I grew up like that. Oh, and it was different. So it helped them reinforce thoughts as they were older. Or encounters that they had with people or certain teachers, it got re-signified later. But also, there was one individual I interviewed, and he had studied biology. And he, just because of that career, he was very clear of how we were all interconnected, how we were part of nature, not just users of nature. And that had shaped his thinking and his worldview in a very different way than all the other leaders who came more from business, who had done engineering or went into finance or business administration. So for those that didn't have this biology background, they had to come to an understanding in another way. For the guy who studied biology, it was very natural, you know. He never thought that was a special way of looking into the world. But for the others, it was a before and after.
I'm really interested in coming back to this something you just said a few minutes ago about how do we get more intentional about this. I mean, if you take something like connection to nature, for instance, or, you know, maybe not go as far as doing a biology degree, but, you know, connecting young people to nature is potentially within the grasp of almost all young people. Is that a gross oversimplification to think about how we get more intentional, or is it more subtle than that?
I was questioned very much by one of my advisors when I was doing my dissertation, when he was questioning my term intentionality. But I saw that there was a lot of power behind being intentional, and because intentionality calls for a degree of awareness, okay, I want to do this and I'm going to go in this direction. Or in my case, what is it that we can include so that it just doesn't happen because we don't know why, but we created some path that people can walk and everybody chooses a different path. But maybe we have different paths that can help someone have this type of experiences and develop that type of awareness. So nature became a wonderful and easy way to create that type of experience. And it has to be a lived experience. You know that I do faculty development now. So I help adult educators to understand what are these elements that they can embed into their courses. But the way they learn it is by doing it themselves. So, for example, recently there was one professor who was very interested in how he can embed or develop a new mindset with his students. And there was an exercise that was taking, spending an hour in nature alone and without a phone and without anything to write or no music, just be there and taking that experience wherever it takes you. And he didn't do it. He thought about it. He thought, how would it be if I did that? But that was not the same experience as doing it. Because there is something that is just this phenomenology of being in a place. It's something we cannot anticipate by thinking, how will I feel when I'm there? It's like imagining cold weather. You know, we cannot really imagine how it is, a cold weather or a hot weather. So as a result, he keeps asking, how will I develop this mindset with my student? So I think having the experience gives us a level of knowledge that is pre-verbal. It's surrounding. I don't know. We don't have words to describe this properly yet. But it creates a very powerful message that we get, and we then struggle to find for words to explain it.
So there's a growing body of evidence now to suggest that there are physiological and psychological benefits to green time, if you like, connection to nature, and leaving the technology behind. People that I'm aware of are like Eric Sigmund, who's written about concrete kids, and you know the profound effect it has on you know the way their brain's wired, sort of hormone releases, and all sorts of different things that bringing people physically into contact with nature has positive effects for. If that's the case, you know why don't we see more commitment and investment to those kind of measures for all young people growing up? Because I mean, just going back to what you were saying about these formative experiences, these lived experiences being a common feature of legacy mindset leaders, it's clear to me that that those experiences are a key ingredient for when someone finds themselves into a leadership position, them having that level of commitment to act at a very deep level. Of course, it's not a prerequisite to them being successful, but it means when they get themselves into those leadership positions, there's a much greater likelihood of them acting in a certain way. So, if that's the case, you know, surely we should be investing in more young people having these formative experiences in a more intentional way. And yet I don't see it happening, not at scale.
Well, I think when nature is one way where we can get a lot of benefits out of that exposure, out of that experience, it's not the only way. And it has another very important factor is pausing. And maybe when you go in nature and you don't have your phone and you're alone and you're forced to pause because you're there, you don't have anything to do other than being there for 1 hour. And that forces you to pause and to sort of become more aware of your own train of thought. So pausing, we are in a doing civilization, right? It's all about to-do lists and how can we get more things done and faster. And it's a doing civilization. But if we can balance it with a little time to concentrate on the being dimension, as I call it, we get a different message and we connect with a different level of wisdom. So in nature, it forces us to pause. And at the same time, when we pause, the noises that we are surrounded with because of our technology, of what we self-create into our lives, they get a little bit silenced. So what emerges there? What other voices are we able to hear that are related to our values, maybe, to asking these deeper questions, very basic questions. Who am I? Why am I here? When I say who am I, that relates to identity. What are an identity means what are the anchors of our identity? So if you ask a student six times, why is he studying? The first one was so I can graduate and get a job and get some good money. And then you ask again, so why? Oh, so I can have a better living and have a house and grow a family. Okay, why? Well, because after two, three whys, now we are getting at the deeper levels. We are asking, so why really do you want to do it? So we get at the value levels. When we get at the value levels, we can hear ourselves stating things, and then we say, well, is that really the way I want to do it? And that is the anchor, because we have all that wisdom inside. We have a wisdom that teaches us how to go along with others, how to go along with nature, how to live in a way that is not damaging ourselves, others, and the environment. We have that wisdom there, but you know, there's so many noises. It's like trying to have a conversation in a disco. It's just too loud. We cannot. So we do minimal exchanges. And what this nature is a way. It could be an instrument to have that experience. There can be other ways where we can pause and calm down so that we have this time to connect with ourselves. Social sensitivity. It's another thing that, how do we develop that? This care for others, for whether it is human or non-human, biospheric others, how do we develop that social sensitivity? By exposure. When we are with people that are unfamiliar to us, we connect. And you know this, when I know something, I understand it. When I understand it, I care for it. You know, there is this thing. Mm-hmm. So what we don't know, we don't understand, and we don't care. And this is not too difficult to embed it into our classes, into our workshops, helping create these links for getting closer, learning about it. Then we understand it. Then we care. And then our behaviors change because we have changed.
So that's all wrapped up with empathy developing an appreciation for the other. Even if it's not someone who's like you, it's appreciating diversity and difference. Something that that a number of my other interviewees have spoken to me about has been empathy. And I'm just be curious on your take on things like the use of, I mean, I know the SDG Action Lab, for instance, have invested in a series of virtual reality tools for use in schools to enable someone to walk in the shoes of a child refugee, or you know people in certain contexts that, you know, with the best will in the world, unless you're to go and volunteer overseas in those kind of environments, it seems very distant, other than what you see on the news. So it's a tool for enabling someone to appreciate, you know, what someone else is going through. I mean, do you see things like that being a help, or is there no replacement for the physical interaction?
Well, everything helps, right? If we can, you said three words that are very key: in your shoes. In your shoes is a very important evolutionary development in how we make meaning out of the world. If you are familiar with integral psychology, how they map out the different ways of making meaning out of the world, and when we are in one stage, that is how we understand the world and how we, based on what we will act out there. To be able to step into someone else's shoes is an exercise that opens up a different way of seeing yourself and the world. Because once we are in the other person's shoes, we have to see it as the other is seeing it. Now it is in the old term, I do, I you. So how are you seeing it? So it, I am mirroring back from a different perspective. And when I am in those shoes, I am feeling like the person. So now it is an embodied learning. From that embodied learning, it's very difficult to be adversarial. At least we have developed empathy because now we lived it from inside, even if it is a moment. If it is a movie, you know, video game, whatever it is, it will help. It's obviously better if it is a person we meet on the street. But if it is a video game, I've been talking with a video developer in Singapore, and he was very interested in how we could develop contents for videos that help people develop these new skills or this new awareness to step in another person's shoes. Because then it is, now it is part of who you are, and you will bring it to different situations with you. You know, in the more, like in the traditional stage, when we make meaning out of the word, is we have to protect ourselves, our tribe, and outside are the enemies. It is the division between good and evil. And it's a survival mode. We have to defend. And you see it today. We will see it in far right movements. They say, well, the bad guys are outside. We have to close our borders because we have to protect ourselves. It's for survival. When we go into the next level of making meaning of the word, we can go through this stepping into the other person's shoes. Now we say, oh, wait a moment, but how does it feel to be a refugee? How does it feel to be a person who got through domestic violence? How does it feel? I have met one person or I have felt it. Now we cannot be from this me good, you bad outside, an enemy and threat. These frontiers become membranes where something circulates in and out. So that these are evolutionary movements that we as a humanity are going through and are in an accelerated pace. That's the good news, that this we have been like this for 10,000 years, but now it is happening at a very fast pace, that we have come from protecting ourselves from the bad enemy to say, wait a moment, who is that enemy? Why did he act out like that? What were the motivations? Is it a person that is sick? Is it a person that had trauma? So we start, this still will not justify the violence, but it will enhance our understanding. And this, we can embed it in with, as you say, with tools, with instruments, with games. There are many possibilities that we have today to help create these situations with leaders or with students or even with young children.
I think it's fascinating that that the game industry is taking an interest in this. I mean, that for a long time now, they've been criticised, rightly or wrongly, by many, to parent groups and so on, and certainly psychology experiments that have demonstrated that a lot of games, particularly the combat games, reduce empathy rather than improve it. So, but they're powerful tools, and I'm afraid that, you know, the genie's out of the bottle in terms of children, young people wanting to play them. And they do learn stuff through them. My own children guided us when we went on holiday to Venice, round Venice, because of they knew it inside out from a game they'd played. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on that you said was talking about this innate wisdom. It's as though wisdom's there in all of us. It just has to be brought out, rather than it being, you know, we start as empty vessels. And you have to develop it somehow through age and experience and life's events. Can you just unpack that a little bit more for us in terms of why you think it's, first of all, what do we know about its innateness in terms of something that resides within each and every one of us? And why is it that it's so concealed, other than, I mean, you talked about the noise around us that we don't can't quieten our minds enough to allow it to come forward.
A number of years ago, I was doing a research about an approach to learning called action reflection learning that developed in Sweden in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to code that approach because it was a number of practices and it was not clear why was that, what were the core principles behind that approach. And so in the process of coding, one of the aspects that I came was tacit knowledge. And how did I came? Well, one of the, let's say, one of the techniques used in by action learning practitioners was using the question, and they asked, instead of giving answers, they used questions. And so they were saying, well, we are not a traditional lecturer or trainer, but if we want to develop leaders, we will ask them questions and they will find the answers. Or for example, there was a book that the participants of a workshop would get at the beginning of a training, and it was called, I think, Leadership. It's a hardcover book. But when they opened it, it was empty. And it was all blank pages, but it was bound like a book. So what do you mean? This is the textbook for the course. Oh, okay, and they open it, empty. What does it mean? Well, you figure out what you think it means. So, and when I, and that was, I found that these questions and asking these questions was so powerful, but I said, what is the principle behind that? And I called it tacit knowledge. And when I started to see where in our culture did we have already this principle present, I found it in many different ways. And you already are thinking of it, I'm sure. Well, if Socrates kept asking questions, he said, well, because meiotika, you know, the knowledge is there. We will just have to help bring it out with the right questions. If you have ever gone to a therapy, you know that the therapist will not give you the answer. He will ask you the question.
Right.
If you had some experience in Zen Buddhism, you know it's not about the answer. It's about what are the questions and how do you... And so I started to find in different disciplines that this principle over and over was coming out as a way to signal that there is a wisdom there that we have. We just don't know or we don't trust it or whatever it is. So through different tools or mechanisms, people have been helping others access this knowledge or this wisdom. So it is not something new. I think it has been around for very long. And then the next question is, like you said, why are we not hearing it? So that is interesting. There is a guy called Gil McChrist. He wrote an interesting book where he was researching what happened in our civilization. When did the rational, the logic, the control, sort of the left brain functions take over, because we have so much knowledge that is pre-verbal, that is not logical, that is our first way to get to understand, receive information from the world is non-verbal. But then we try to make meaning, and that goes to through our right brain mostly. And then we start to try to express it in words and images, and and it's always imperfect. But that is what we do. But he's made this very interesting, very thorough research how our culture became that the left brain became the master, the one that says how things are. And so it is how we control it, how we explain it, how we share it in scientific ways, the whole enlightenment process. But that doesn't mean that the other part is not there. And maybe there is a lot of information there that we are not very used to access. So one easy way is to shut up, to stop these distractors, these stimuli that we fill our lives with, and stay quiet. And then a lot of information we can hear it. It comes to us, whether it is through meditation. There are many different, or through doing art, or through listening to music. There are many ways where we can access this information, being in silence. So it is there.
Right. And I think individually, a lot of people recognize that. It organizationally, it seems to me it's often quite difficult to give people permission to do so. Maybe because we're still caught up in this doing rather than being kind of mode, confusing activity with achievement. So to that extent, it seems helpful that an increasing number of senior leaders, CEOs, and so on, high-profile people in the business world, certainly, and elsewhere, are becoming more open about practicing mindfulness or meditation, or you know, the love of music, or you know, the kind of softer, more human side to how they cope with their responsibility, how they assimilate everything they're trying to deal with. How they make sense, how they make decisions, and lean on these kind of tools. And that kind of normalizes it for others, and it gives permission to others to do the same. What's your sense of how prevalent within, let's say, just the business community alone, is sort of recognition of tapping quietness and tapping into wisdom as being an important thing?
Well, I think the wording gets in the way because if we approach someone, and it happened to me when I was doing my interviews, I asked, for example, did spirituality play a role in who you are or what you became? And I had all kinds of reactions. Like, oh no, you know, I don't believe that there is a higher self there guiding me. Oh, you need to go this path, be a good man. No, I don't believe that. Very postmodern. So, but I think that we all have our values and we have to live authentic lives. So I think when we find the right wording so that people don't react to the word and close themselves up to an understanding that they already may have. Sometimes the best wording is going through the door of the stress. Oh, what do you do to manage your stress? And what are the little resources that you have that charge your batteries? Oh, you know, when I just go for a walk, or I can't remember the last time I was in the ocean. I love it, you know, then I forget. I really feel that my stress goes down. So we all have our little resources. We don't have to call it, why don't you develop some meditation practice? Because not everybody's open for that. So I think the wording plays an important role. And for example, when I work with students, particularly in business schools, I never say, okay, we will do a meditation now. I say, okay, we will spend the first 2 minutes in silence. Okay, silence is not meditation. And maybe we build it up gradually so that people have a chance to put their feet into the water and not to feel bad, but actually feel open and more welcoming to something that was not bad or maybe was good. And, you know, after a few weeks, you hear them saying, oh, are we going to do meditation today? Are we going to do our special check-in today? Or we forgot it last time. And so they start to ask for it because they can sense that it is good for them to manage their stress levels or their anxiety or whatever it is. The younger people, they're sort of more open. I have found it that they are more open to reflect, more open to review, why are you doing what you're doing? I am very hopeful.
It's just as long as each individual can find what works for them to allow them to access that inner wisdom and that quietness.
I think we can make suggestions. No? This reminds me to when, you know, I have a coaching. I've been doing a lot of coaching over the years. And one of the questions when training coaches is what people say, okay, if I make an intervention, how can I make sure it will be good for that person? And so you will never know until they react. That is the only way you can see if something will work for one person or not. So how open will you be to make a suggestion and see if that works or that doesn't work? Because we are also different and we are different every day. So I think to offer tools or possibilities, it's good. We can do it from our expertise in something, or we know well, being in nature can be useful for you, so we can suggest, but it should never become as a prescription, but as an invitation, and so that the person can sense, does it work for me now, today, or no, rather not. Otherwise, we put ourselves in the role of the teacher, the old fashion teacher. No, this is what you need to do because I say so and I know it's good for you. That doesn't work.
So if you had a magic wand in terms of thinking, you have one. listeners can't see Isabel waving a magic wand at me that I wasn't expecting. So with your magic wand in hand, what two or three things do you think would make the biggest difference to seeing a recognition of the value of experiences that awaken the inner wisdom?
You know, this is a question I've been asking myself for a long time, and it's a question that guides me, because I never have the full answer. And my question is, how can I get the highest leverage from whatever tools I have with my own skills for the limited time that I have? So I'm always looking, what are these points of leverage that have the highest impact? And I think educators, they reach individuals, and the individuals impact their group of peers, and the individuals live in families, so it impacts their families, and it has a chance to impact the community or their working environment. I see that is a low barrier with high impact, and low barrier because the audience, the captive audience that educators have, it has huge potential. If I don't know if you have been following what these kids, these teenagers have started since there was the last shooting here in Florida.
Yeah.
You know, there is one that I think it was over a weekend, she got over $1 million dollars that people donated to it, and she didn't even know what for. People started to send them funds. And it was over a weekend. And so they said, oh, we better get organized because now we have this. What will you use it? Well, we will do a march to Washington and we will go there. But, you know, it wasn't, oh, this is our project and we have a business plan. No, it was like we have the passion and we want to stand up. And here comes all this support from different places that just empowers them even more. So I think that this audience is like a big sleeping giant of potential, because young people, they are just yearning for purpose. They want to do something with their energies. They yearn for purpose, for making a difference, to stand up, to be the ones, to change the world. So how can we nurture them so that when they go and that they ask themselves the right questions, that they operate from a social sensitivity, that we develop this empathy, this standing in the other person's shoes, together with collaboration skills, together with knowing yourself, what are your anchors of your identity, so that you start in a journey of authenticity. It's a journey, you never finish it. You make little progress, but it's a journey. But once they start there, that doesn't stop. So I think we have a huge unused potential there. And educators, if you want to touch youth one by one, but educators have maybe 50, 100, 200 students in a year or more. So that is a way to, which I have found makes a huge impact, has a big potential. I don't know, women.
Women?
Well, yes, because women have a lot of, are closer. You know, in our values, women have are closer to the sense of interconnectedness. They are able to think in the long term because biologically, through maternity, their mm-hmm. bodies are have the blueprint to think in the long term. And compassion and empathy and collaboration skills, all these things that our culture in the last 5,000 years has set aside, but all these skills are. And the Dalai Lama once said the world will be saved by the women because they bring these other contributions that are missing. So taking care, empathy, compassion, taking care, working collaboratively, and these big challenges that we have, we cannot solve them alone in an individualistic way. We have to collaborate. So they are bringing a lot of these skills that are closer. It's the feminine energy. We both have it, but women embody it, and men have been trained culturally not to pay attention to that, to be tough, to be to make it. To
Do you know, I'm glad you said that, because you've taken the words right out of my mouth in defense of the male of the species, because I absolutely agree with what you say. But I think my sense of it is that for men it mostly feels like it's there, but it's suppressed. We're just not expected to behave that way.
We're not at
ease with behaving that way as women are.
But you know, I think there's an interesting field there, Tony, that I wish we could explore more in the coming years. What if we get all this information through our right brain? We have the connection with the other. We see how things are interconnected. We have the sensitivity. Then we come and try to put it into the rational, logical sequence where we don't count on that information. So what is the relationship between acknowledging and listening to this way of understanding the world and gender stereotypes? How are we biased? And it's like we are only using half of our capacity, both in the brain and in these skills, to operate in the world. And if we can unite it, you feel it, you find it a lot in Aboriginal and in indigenous tribes. No? They are more integrated. They can connect, not all of them, but they have a better understanding of the interconnectedness. You remember this this story of, I think it is the Maasai, who, when there's a conflict in the tribe, the first thing is that they hide the weapons from the, so the two people that have a conflict don't have access to the weapons, and they have to sit together and for as long as they can, until they solve their issue, and people bring them food, but you don't move until you solve this in a way without weapons. So this is this is feminine energy. So we can collaborate. We have to work through this together without killing each other. It's an evolutionary step. Oh, in the beginning, we had to kill the other so that we could survive. I don't know. We have to solve it together. So there is something about these skills that are unused, and I call it the feminine energy, but we all have it. And maybe, how is this connected with our two brain halves? I don't know.
So your sense as a researcher and as an educator is that I love the phrase you used, that the young generation coming through are a yearning for purpose. And that's wonderful. I mean, it's just that gives us all hope. But the challenge it presents then to employers, to educators, to the rest of us, really, that in the adult population, to fulfil on that promise, you know, to do all we can to support that, so it doesn't get suppressed in due course, and that they're not left with this massive sense of dissatisfaction, disappointment, in the world they've inherited. You know, seems to me as much of a challenge as the environmental challenge we're facing, and so on. You know,
yeah. You know, I'm not sure. I think that because they are so connected to the world through their devices, they are not waiting for a teacher or an adult, a boss to tell them their things. They will selectively go with the understanding that they feel it's the right, and they learn from each other around the world. I was the other day having my hair done, and I asked her, she's like a master's student, and I said, so what is your specialty? She is a makeup artist. Oh, and where did you learn it? Are you tubes?
Yeah, my daughter too.
Yeah, tubes. You know, what do you mean? I have to go to an institute. And she had and that will be her career, what she said. So they have different, they are not waiting for someone to come and get a transformation. If you don't have the right mindset, get a transformation and learn how to teach them. You know, they will find, like water finds the cracks, and they will find it. And they, these days, they have, young people have all these resources. They will not wait for someone to tell them, like these kids in here walking to Washington. They are not waiting for someone to listen and come and listen. They will go. And that has ripple effects that go way beyond what we can control. Look what happened with the Me Too movement. You know, it was not about women in Hollywood. Now people in India say, oh, what about me? So that is a wonderful time, because it is the turning around of the pyramid. We grow up, you and I, Tony, this generation, we grew up in a pyramid where there were a few on the top that had the power, and we believed it, and we said, oh, too bad, we don't have the power. Too bad the politicians have the power, too bad the big corporations have the power. You know, that is no longer the case. Now we are in the inverted pyramid. Now it is a broad base that has, through the access of information, it creates a different level, because it creates, through the transparency, now that becomes a regulation. And when people start to realize that that is where they have the power, I think it will go, despite if we get it or not get it. So I wouldn't worry that we don't get it.
I love that description of the inverted pyramid, and I hadn't thought of it that way at all, and it makes complete sense. And if it's true, then it fills us with hope, in terms of all of the dissonance that we see at the moment, in terms of, you know, people not bringing themselves to work and presenting a veneer to the world that they think everyone else wants to see, and all of that, you know, kind of need for purpose getting left at the door. What you've described kind of, you know, paves the way for people being authentic, people being true to themselves.
And, you know, it only requires, the tipping point is when 10% of population get it. That creates the tipping point. Because with the media today, we don't have to wait until someone writes a book about it and it gets printed, becomes a bestseller. No, we don't have to wait. Everybody does a YouTube, you have this news. And if the American way of life became the inspiration and the goal for so many people around the world, now there are these new models with young people that say, you know, I'm going to make it, and I want the quality of life, and I want this. You have this new age, but the new age people that are in the millennials or in the 30s, 40s, and they say, well, that is the world. That is how I want my life. So how can I do it? They are doing it. I I think there is a, we are passing a tipping point, a wonderful tipping point.
What a positive place to end it. Isabel, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Change Hackers.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity of thinking these things.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, Change Hackers.